You're listening to The Exchange. Here's today's show.
Brian, thank you very much, and welcome, everybody, to The Exchange. I'm Tyler Matheson. In today for Kelly Evans, here's what we got planned for you. Geopolitics, earnings, economic data, the Fed. We're setting up for another big week for the markets. It could cement or derail the Fed's higher for longer tilt. We'll look at what to watch, why one of our guests still sees a cut this year, and where to find value against this economic backdrop. Plus, Netflix sharply lower despite a big subscriber beat, but that metric is going away. They're not going to report it anymore after a while. Investors punishing the stock because of that, but should they? Our analyst says they shouldn't. And airline earnings off to a strong start, but there is a, oh, this is a word I love, bifurcation in that trade. Wall Street's top airline analyst is here with what that bifurcation is and how to position from here. And now a quick check on the markets. Traders have shaken off Israel's counterstrike on Iran by and large. The Dow is up now, was up about 200 points. Right now it's up 0.52%. The Nasdaq, the biggest laggard. Netflix, the biggest drag on that index. More on Netflix, of course. Oil and gold prices initially spiked on the attack. They, however, have pulled back, as you see there. West Texas crude up about 1%, gold up about 0.75%. Bitcoin crossed back above $65,000 earlier, below that now, but still up about 2%. Also watching that trade ahead of Bitcoin's halving set to take place later today. We will have more on the potential impact on Bitcoin prices and on the miners that is coming up. But first, let's start with the big headlines of the day and the biggest concerns or catalysts for markets from here. Eurasia Group's Greg Brew with whether Israel and Iran can walk away, each thinking they won. Steve Leisman and UBS economist Brian Rose with the latest on the economy and the Fed and why next week could be critical. And Wells Fargo's Mark Smith on how to position amid all the noise. Let's start, though, with Greg Brew, Iran and energy analyst at the Eurasia Group. Greg, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me on.
So are we at a point, given what I would characterize as the tempered response by Israel to Iran's attack last weekend, and in turn, what seems like Iran's tempered response to what Israel has done, can we close this chapter now? Is that likely?
I think we can close this chapter for precisely the two reasons that you gave. First, Israel's response to Iran's historic attack does look pretty measured, right? As far as we can tell, the reports indicate that Israel did three things. It launched airstrikes against Iran's allies in Syria, something that it's done many times in the past. It launched a drone attack inside Iran using its agents and covert elements, again, something that it's done in the past. And it also launched missiles directly into Iran, something that Israel has not done in the past. But it did so on a small scale. So by all appearances, what Israel did appeared to be pretty calibrated, pretty limited. That's one element that would suggest we're in a de-escalatory trend. The other element, as you noted, the Iranians have responded to this attack in a pretty muted way. There seems to be a pretty concerted effort from Iran, from the regime, from its media, to downplay this attack. Iranian officials are broadly denying reports that Israel fired missiles directly into Iran. They seem to want to let this go. They seem willing to absorb it, so long as it means further de-escalation. So I think for now, we can be pretty confident that this chapter has closed, but that's no guarantee that we might see another crisis if things come to blows between Israel and Iran at some point in the future.
And I guess the big risk, the most immediate proximate risk to economic activity would be anything that jeopardized the Straits of Hormuz, which Iran has shown no signs of doing in this particular instance.
Absolutely. I mean, we hear rhetoric from Iran all the time. They threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz if they feel their interests are being threatened. It's a threat they like to do quite often. But we're not seeing any indication that they're anywhere near doing something that extreme. That, of course, would affect all the oil flowing through the straits. It would mean war, very likely, between Iran and its Gulf neighbors, as well as the United States. But, you know, it bears pointing out, Iran is also exporting quite a lot of crude through the strait. It's moving at least 1.5 million barrels a day. Almost all of it's going to China. This in spite of U.S. sanctions. That's not a crude flow that the Iranians want to disrupt. So right now, I don't see a huge amount of risk to the strait.
I was listening this morning to Iranian academic on the BBC radio, and he had an interesting take. I don't know what to make of it, but let me lay it out here for you and get your reaction to it. The take pertained to last Saturday's assault by Iran on Israel. And this individual said that even though there was little damage done to Israel, Israel knocked out and its allies knocked out 99% of the projectiles fired into Israel, it was still a victory for Iran because it forced the West and Israel and Israel's allies to spend a tremendous amount of very high-end weaponry to knock out of the skies 200 very cheap drones. And Iran comes away with, therefore, an asymmetric win. In other words, we spent less than you spent. You've now depleted your arsenal. And we, the Iranians, got a lot of valuable intelligence from how you and your friends responded. How does that strike you?
Well, I think there is an argument to be made that what the Iranians have done with this attack is demonstrate capability, right? They have a large arsenal of drones and ballistic and cruise missiles, and now they've used them. And they've used them to demonstrate that they have this power. They can hit Israel if they want to. And they've done it, you know, largely to restore deterrence following Israel's attack on Iran's consulate in Damascus. So in that sense, it is something of a win. It also reflects a trend that we've seen elsewhere in the regional crisis, reflected, of course, by what the Houthis have been doing in the Red Sea over the last several months. The Houthis have been armed and equipped by Iran. So we've seen many examples over the last several months of what these drones and missiles can do. But again, going back to Israel's management of this attack, Israel and the United States and other allies were able to shoot down the vast majority of these projectiles. It was something of a dramatic success for Israeli air defenses. Contrast that to what has happened in Iran in the last 24 hours. Israel, by all reports, was able to fire multiple missiles into Iran, striking targets deep within Iranian territory. The Iranians were not able to stop it. The Israelis have shown their own capabilities, and so I think both sides can come away with a sense of victory here. Both sides have demonstrated the power that they could unleash were things to get worse. They have demonstrated capability. They have restored a degree of deterrence.
Very interesting. And as we began, you said it seems possible that this could be the closing of this particular chapter. Greg Brew, thank you very much. Have a good weekend, sir. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
All righty. Here at home, we are setting up for a big week of economic reports, including GDP and PCE, the Fed's preferred inflation gauge. Our next guest sees inflation slowing, and he still sees a cut in the cards this September. Joining us now, Brian Rose, senior U.S. economist at UBS Global Wealth Management. Also with us, CNBC senior economics reporter Steve Leisman. Let me begin with you, Steve. How have we gone from a forecast of six rate cuts, six at the beginning of the year, now down to maybe one, maybe two, maybe zero?
Tyler, would you mind if I corrected you for a moment?
Of course.
There wasn't actually at least a forecast from the Fed for six cuts. There was a pricing in futures markets for six rate cuts, which was double the Fed's forecast. So there's actually been two stages of this. One is the market coming down to where the Fed is, 6-3, and now a question of is it 3, 2, 1, or 0? So that's, we're sort of in that phase right now. And I think it's happened in a couple phases. The Fed ran an open mouth operation to kind of bring the market down to where it was when it came to 3. And then the data started coming in a little difficult when it came to inflation. And this 3 months of slower progress on inflation has the Fed sort of backing off this idea of, A, it's likely appropriate to cut this year. We don't even hear that anymore. And we also don't hear these forecasts. For example, Goolsbee speaking this morning had earlier very openly talked about his forecast for 3 cuts from the March SEP. He doesn't talk about that anymore.
All right. Let me turn to you, Brian, if I might. Where are you on the number and timing of interest rate cuts this year, if any? And I guess more poignantly, or maybe pointedly, what will it take for the Fed to decide that they are ready to cut interest rates? What data will they need to see, and for how long?
Well, our base case is that the first cut will be in September, and then we see another cut in December. Of course, this all depends on how the data actually comes in. And from the Fed's perspective, at the moment, the biggest problem is the inflation data. So after very good prints in the second half of last year, all 3 months of the CPI data we had so far this year are too high. And those numbers will have to come down for the Fed to cut. But it's not all bad news for the Fed if you're looking to cut. One of the big things that I think doesn't get enough attention is that wage growth has slowed and continues on a downward trend. This makes it a lot easier for the Fed to cut because it has implications on the medium-term outlook for inflation, which is really what the Fed's concern is, right? They want to know, where's inflation going to be 2025, 2026? Are we heading towards the target? And the slower wage growth, helps them to reach the target over the medium term.
So, Chair Powell, go ahead, Steve, jump in.
Yeah, Brent, I wanted you to sort of solve a problem that I have. The first quarter PCE, we get it coming this Friday, an important number, but the Fed's already forecast it, and most forecasters probably have it right. Core PCE is going to come in at 2.8. The average for the quarter is going to be 2.8. The Fed forecasts 2.6% for the full year. We're 0.2 off of the forecast for the full year. When it forecasts 2.6, the average Fed official forecasts 3 rate cuts. So Tyler and I were talking about this the other day, about losing your kingdom for a horse. Would you give up all 75 basis points of rate cuts because you're running 0.2 hotter than you expected? Doesn't that seem extreme?
Yeah, this is a really good point, is that if you look at the Fed's forecast from back in March, they were looking for strong growth. Now, certainly, their forecasts are above consensus.
Right.
As you said, the 2.6 for PCE inflation at the end of the year, and we're still willing to cut 3 times. So we're not miles away from what we need to see for the Fed to cut. I think the problem, though, is that especially if you just look at a chart of the monthly core CPI prints, it's not clear that it's actually slowing. If you look at a chart, it looks like, if anything, inflation is picking up, and that's a big problem. Also, the way that the March inflation data missed, which is a big increase in core services ex shelter, which is, Powell's been talking about since 2022. So the way the inflation data missed was troubling, and the recent trend is troubling. So, I mean, you need the inflation data to improve, but as you're suggesting, not by a huge amount. I would say if we had 0.2s on core PCE going forward, that would be enough for the Fed to cut.
All right, gentlemen, we have to leave it there. Alas, have a good weekend. Brian Rose, Steve Leisman, thank you very much. Well, when I spoke with our next guest, he already expected no rate cuts this year. That was back 2 months ago in February. And recent inflation data have only cemented his view now. For more on where he sees opportunity from here, let's welcome back Mark Smith, Senior Vice President and Portfolio Manager at Wells Fargo Advisors. Mark, welcome back. So you said you didn't see rate cuts 2 months ago. We spoke on the 16th of February. It's now the, 18th or 19th of April. What do you see now? Same?
Back in 2 months ago, I was really just looking at the numbers, just like many other portfolio managers and financial advisors around the country, just looking at CPE, PPI, employment rates. And we really didn't see any reason why a Fed should cut rates. And so that's why I had that thesis. I think going forward, I think one thing that you've got to really look at is November, right? We're in an election year. And it's really hard to see that Powell wants to play this kind of role of raising or lowering rates in an environment where November's the election. He doesn't want to come out looking favorable to either party. So I think it makes sense just to stay the course. And December would be the closest possible date you'd see any kind of movement from the Fed because of the election.
So what does that imply then for what I should do with my money? I mean, you have some things you like. You like the XLE, energy. You like gold, SMH. I guess that's semiconductors, big tech.
Yeah. Yeah. So listen, I think that XLE up 12.8% year to date, I think it's going to be even more of a play because of what's going on in the Middle East. If you see the Strait of Hormuz get disrupted, it doesn't have to be Iran. It could be a number of different actors.
Could be the Houthis.
Exactly. And so if that happens, You could predict anywhere for 2 to 5% increase in energy around the world. All right, that's 20% of all crude oil around the world goes through that strait. And listen, we are in a new phase between Israel and Iran in regards to what they're capable of and what they're doing. And so everyone's on edge. All my clients are wondering how this plays out. And so you're looking at to hedge, buy gold. And if you're thinking that this is going to be an ongoing issue, you got to own energy.
Would those edged customers and clients, and yourself included, would you be a little less on edge because of what has just happened overnight with Israel attacking Iran, but in what appears to be a relatively tempered way? So maybe some of that tension is dissipating just a bit.
Listen, you can grab at straws anywhere you want, but they just fired 100 missiles in Israel, and then Israel just attacked them 24 hours ago. So if you're feeling comfortable, I don't know why. And so I think that they are de-escalating verbally. I'd like to see that happen actually. And so until that happens, I think that every investor should get defensive.
So what should I do if I have some cash that I want to take out of my equity portion of my portfolio, perhaps because it's grown up against the upper bound, not because of anything I've done, but just because it's expanded so far this year. And I want to put it to work in fixed income. Where would you put it? And at what maturities?
Listen, I think that fixed income is an important part for investors who are looking for income, and they're also looking for preservation of capital. But that hasn't happened in the last 3 years in fixed income market. So I have a lot of clients that are looking at money market rates. They're over 5% right now. Great place to hide out while you're doing that. Also, with the President Biden talking about $400,000 or more, you're going to be taxed more. A lot of folks are talking about munis now and where they can go to protect some of their hard-earned money and go into an environment, fixed income investment that'll be tax efficient, right? Yeah. You can get triple tax exemption if you're getting a muni in your state. So those are all things that clients are talking about and where they should be invested in.
So you don't expect a rate cut until at the earliest December of this year. What will it take to cause that to happen? What will the Fed need to see and for how long?
You'd have to see some serious things happening with the employment rate. You'd have to see core CPE go way below 2.6. I mean, there's a number of different factors that we're all looking at. And right now, none of those are saying and screaming out to the Fed they need to make a rate cut. So I think politically, which I think is obviously we always have to think about when you're thinking about the government, November is the date that they've got to wait before they make any significant decision in this election. So jury's still out, and I think November is
over. You made a bold, counterintuitive call back in February, and you're doubling down basically at this time. Appreciate your clarity.
Absolutely. Mark, good to see you again, Tyler.
Yeah, same to you. All right, coming up, Netflix shocking Wall Street, saying it's going to stop reporting subscriber growth numbers next year, but today's stock reaction is similar to when Apple said it would stop reporting unit sales a few years ago, and those shares have tripled since then. So what does the news mean for the rest of the media landscape? We'll get an analyst take next. Plus, the quadrennial event taking the crypto world by storm. Bitcoin supply about to be cut in half for the first time in 4 years. But this time around, it's very different. And not just because it's been embraced by the biggest institutions on Wall Street. We've got details ahead about the great halving. The exchange is back after this.
This is The Exchange on CNBC.
All right, welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Netflix just blew earnings expectations out of the water yesterday. The streaming giant beat on both the top and the bottom line, even reported a 16% quarter-over-quarter jump in subscribers, from the year prior, 16% jump in subscribers. So why is the stock down 9% for its worst day in 2 years? Well, the company said it's no longer going to share quarterly membership numbers. That begins next year. They also issued a relatively weak second quarter revenue guidance, which has Wall Street a little bit worried. Our next guest still sees Netflix as a buy, and he's got a $725 a share price target on it. That's up $175 from here. That's the highest on the street, implying a 30% rally. He's John Blackledge. He's the internet analyst at TD Cowen. John, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
So let's bear down on what seems to have the market worried today, and that is the cessation of providing net new subscribers and average revenue per user going forward starting next year. Is that as big a deal as the market seems to be making it?
I don't think so, Tyler. They're going to pull the member number and the average revenue per member metrics next year. But they did tell us they're going to give full year guide range, and they actually gave it for 2024 last night. And I just don't think it's a big deal. They told us they're going to talk about what drives revenue quarter in, quarter out. And they're also going to periodically give, kind of member milestone updates. Mm-hmm. So I think it'll be fine. And the other thing that I think people forget, I've covered Netflix for about 15 years, but in 2012, they eliminated some metrics. They eliminated churn, gross member adds. And at the time it was kind of a big deal, but then it wasn't. And so I think it'll be kind of something similar. And the company also explained, they introduced an ad tier. They have various different price points across all different kinds of geographies or regions. So what we're saying today is it's not that big of a deal. It was a really good start to the year. We remain bullish near and longer term and think it's a good opportunity for investors that were on the sidelines to maybe get involved.
So let me squeeze in one more on this change and what they're going to report. I guess there could be sort of two explanations here. On the one hand, they could be ceasing to give these net adds and revenue per customer numbers because those numbers are less relevant today than they used to be. On the other hand, they could be doing it because they're worried that the numbers are not going to be as favorable as they have been. Which is it in your view?
The former. They're relevant. They're a little less relevant. I mean, I think what they've told us, right, is they're going to grow revenue 13 to 15% this year, and then they expect to grow revenue double digits in the coming years. And that's a function of member growth and average revenue per member growth, as well as, kind of their ramping advertising business. So there's just more things going into driving revenue now, and it's not as clear cut than, kind of looking at the member and the revenue per member. And so that's why they're kind of pulling it.
Their numbers on the trailing quarter were really, really good and included adds of subscribers. It included an EPS beat, a revenue beat, and so on and so forth. So it was really good. The only weak spot, I guess, was a little squishy, was second quarter revenue forecast, right?
Yeah, the 2Q revenue was light, but there's also, kind of some FX headwinds there. So, that was, I think folks should look past that. And the other thing I would call out is, kind of they gave 13 to 15% top line guide for 2024. That includes some FX headwinds. We have about 16%. We're expecting about 16% top line growth for 2024. So we're a bit above the high end of their guide.
I guess one thing that sort of stands out to me in this area is that the streaming world feels increasingly saturated, I guess is the word I would use. There are a lot of players here, but Netflix is the king of the realm, isn't it?
By far, yeah. They're the global leader. With what the 270-ish million subs are going to spend $17 billion on content this year. And one thing that I thought was interesting.
Is the field saturated, though, I guess would be maybe the better question here. If it is saturated, I'd sure prefer to be Netflix on top of a saturated field than several of the others that are not as strong. Is the field saturated?
Well, there are a number of different streaming platforms, but Netflix is the global leader. We expect them to continue to be the global leader. They've been the most innovative company in this space. Like I was saying, $17 billion in content spend this year. They continue to improve the service. And on a global basis, I mean, you have to look at them and Prime Video, Disney Plus, for us, Netflix will remain the kind of global streaming leader.
John, thank you so much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good to talk to you. Already coming up, we always talk about the impact of artificial intelligence on jobs and the workplace, but one state is using it to identify and help those who are at most at risk for losing their home before it's too late. We have the details on that ahead. Welcome back to The Exchange. I'm Eamon Javers with your news update. The FAA has issued new rest rules for air traffic controllers to address fatigue issues that might be affecting air safety. Controllers will have to rest for 10 hours between shifts and 12 hours before an overnight shift. The rule comes as air safety has been under scrutiny after recent near-miss incidents. The mandate will go into effect in 90 days. The White House will restrict new leases for oil and gas drilling on the 13 million acre National Petroleum Reserve in Alaska in an effort to protect the native wildlife in the face of climate change. The decision from the Interior Department will not change the terms of existing leases or authorized operations, including the controversial Willow Project that was approved last month. For decades, fans have known the New York Mets by their orange and blue uniforms, but no more. The team just unveiled their new City Connect uniforms that they'll wear for several games this season. The team says the inspiration came from the concrete jungle that is New York, and that the letters NYC emblazoned across the chest are an attempt to connect to the whole city, a city they just happened to share with the Yankees. Back over to you guys, Tyler.
Not a fan there, Eamon, of the Mets' new jerseys, but that's maybe just me.
I'll tell you what, Tyler. I grew up in Philly. We only had one baseball team, right? It was the Phillies. We didn't have this whole thing of, like, choosing whether it's the Mets or the Yankees. There's a whole lot of sociological stuff that goes into that, right?
I'm going to consult my father-in-law, who is the world's greatest Met fan. I'll see what he says. I'll bring that information to the viewers sometime
I'll say just
soon.
Go Phils.
All right. Thanks a lot, Eamon.
You bet.
All right. Coming up, Bitcoin's so-called halving event is nearly upon us. And even though it happens roughly every 4 years, this one is different from the rest. We'll tell you why, what it means for investors like you, and for Bitcoin miners. That's next. Welcome back, everybody. It's a big day for crypto as we expect Bitcoin to be having a halving. The supply of new Bitcoin is expected to be cut in half sometime tonight. And while it might be good news for its price, it could be bad news for the miners and other institutions keeping the currency managed. Joining us now to explain all this is Meltem Demirors, advisor and former chief strategy officer at CoinShares. Meltem, welcome. Good to have you with us. In simple terms, what is going on here? What is happening?
Sure. The halving is a very descriptive term. The Bitcoin network uses a proof of work algorithm, which means that miners use energy and computation through these special chips called ASICs to validate blocks. They put transactions that are submitted into the network into these blocks, and people who submit transactions pay fees. Now, as a reward for doing this work, miners compete to earn the Bitcoin block reward. It started out at 50 Bitcoin per block, and then it has halved ever since then. So we went down to 25, 12.5, 6.5, and now 6.25, and now we're going down even more. So basically what that means is there's less inflation, less new Bitcoin mined. And what that means for miners who currently are getting 80 to 90% of their revenue from that block reward and not from those transaction fees, it means their revenue potentially is going down.
Their revenue would go down because they're still going, and their, I guess their profitability, because they're going to still have to invest a set amount of capital, let's put it, to extract half as many Bitcoin or half as much block, right?
Absolutely. But the other component here, right? So miners have fixed costs in the sense that they have chips that they buy. They have data centers that they operate. And what's really fascinating, the Bitcoin network has a $100 billion dedicated hardware and data center economy, over 20 publicly listed Bitcoin miners that command an aggregate market cap of about $20 billion. So this is a pretty big data center economy that's been built around Bitcoin. But what miners can do is they can use lower cost sources of power. So we see a lot of miners switching their facilities on or off, particularly in places like Texas, to take advantage of periods of very low pricing on the grid. So, and the other thing we see is new models emerging for how Bitcoin is creating more transaction fees through ordinals, which are NFTs on Bitcoin, through new tokens on Bitcoin, and all sorts of other innovation.
Well, I understood about a third of what you were talking about there, but I'll take that. I'll take that. But let's cut to what I suspect an awful lot of viewers might be most interested in. This is not the first time there has been a halving. Far from it. It's happened several times before. But what has happened historically to the price of Bitcoin post a halving?
Absolutely. So the reason Bitcoiners like halvings is these four-year cycles give us great data. And over the last three halving cycles we've had, we've seen similar patterns in terms of how Bitcoin's price reacts. Now, I love talking about flows. Bitcoin's price is largely driven by inflows and outflows. So what we've seen since the start of the year with the launch of the 9 new Bitcoin ETFs is over $10 billion of net inflows into Bitcoin just from the ETFs. Over the last 4 weeks or so, we've seen some net outflows, particularly as Bitcoin's price has hovered in the 60 to 65K range. What's unique about this halving, though, typically we would see a new all-time high for Bitcoin 9 to 12 months after a halving. This cycle, we saw Bitcoin hit an all-time high before the halving. So we saw a new all-time high for Bitcoin posted in March. That's pretty unusual. We also have these ETFs that are fundamentally changing the nature of flows into and out of Bitcoin. So I think all bets are off this halving. I'm expecting we'll reach new all-time highs before the end of the year. But again, this cycle is looking a little bit different than the last three we've seen.
All right. Thank you very much, Melton. We appreciate your explanations there. You helped me a lot. I appreciate it.
I'm happy to hear it. Right. One third is good. I'll take
it. Yeah, I get a third. All right. Thanks so much. Have a good weekend. Alrighty, coming up, a big company reorg underway at Alphabet, but there's something else happening at the company that the competition may want to take note of. The details coming up in today's Tech Check. Welcome back, everybody. Alphabet CEO Sundar Pichai has announced big new company reorganization in a memo, consolidating teams to help develop AI products more quickly. But he also hinted at a workplace culture shift for the tech giant. Dieter Bosa has those details for us in today's Tech Check. Hi, Dee.
Tyler, great attention to detail. You also picked up on what I thought was the most interesting part of that memo, and that is the end of it, where Sundar Pichai says in no uncertain terms to his employees, this is a business. Now, it was an indirect way of speaking to the events from earlier on in this week when a group of Google employees staged a sit-in across a number of Google offices, including one in its cloud CEO, Thomas Kurian's office at headquarters. They were protesting a more than $1 billion Israeli government cloud contract. 28 of those employees were almost immediately fired. In that memo, Pichai says Google is not a place to act in a way that disrupts workers, co-workers, or makes them feel unsafe. And to be clear, guys, this sit-in was a new level of disruption that actually led to arrests. But what's important here is that Pichai did not stop there. He went on and he said Google is not a place to, quote, use the company as a personal platform or to fight over disruptive issues or debate politics. And remember that Google was really built on this mantra of don't be evil, the idea that ethics and business go hand in hand. In the age of AI, though, we are seeing this narrative change. This age of AI is arguably the biggest existential risk to Google in decades, generative AI, that is, and it probably requires tougher leadership. So that is what we are seeing hints of now. We will see next week when mega cap earnings get underway, if that's helping financials as well. And that is the big question as we head into the earnings Google reports on Tuesday. How is that search data? How are those search numbers, advertising numbers going to look, Tyler?
All right, Dee, thank you very much. Dieter Bosa reporting. According to data from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, last year, California had more than 181,000 homeless individuals, up more than 30% from 2007. And now Los Angeles County is turning to AI to help find people before they join that statistic. Kate Rogers joins us now with more. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Tyler. L.A. County's Homelessness Prevention Unit has intervened with nearly 800 individuals and families using artificial intelligence to identify people most at risk of losing housing. The program relies on a model that was developed by the California Policy Lab at UCLA. It uses data from seven different L.A. County departments anonymized for privacy, including emergency room visits, behavioral health care, and public benefits programs from food stamps to income support and homeless services. At-risk individuals like Courtney Peterson are found. After being laid off from her job in December, Peterson worried she wouldn't be able to pay rent for herself and her 7-year-old son.
I feared that I was going to have to leave my apartment. I feared that I was going to have to take my son to like a homeless shelter or family shelter.
She and her son received some $8,000 from the county to cover rent, utilities, and basic needs, allowing her to stay put in her apartment while she looks for a new job. The program is largely funded by American Rescue Plan Act dollars. Individuals and families receive between $4,000 and $8,000 to help cover expenses and stay housed. That's just a fraction of the nearly $36,000 a chronically homeless person costs taxpayers a year. And 86% of these people retain permanent housing once they leave the program, according to the county. The solution is preventative and, of course, key for a state that has spent $24 billion in the last few years to tackle homelessness.
Compared to the cost, both financially and from a human trauma perspective, that a person or a jurisdiction incurs when you have such a massive population of people sleeping outside, $4,000 to keep somebody in their housing is more cost effective.
Now, ethicists do raise the concern about AI being utilized by governments, especially around issues of informed consent and privacy of anonymous data. But in LA, help is reaching at least some of the at-risk population, Tyler, when they really need it most.
So what is interesting here in part is the idea that this is not the individuals who are at risk of becoming unhoused reaching out to government. It's the other way around. It's these programs finding them. So what is the reaction of individuals like the young woman you interviewed there when the government does get in touch with them and extend this kind of assistance?
Well, Courtney said basically this help came just in time. She was laid off in December, worried about making January's rent. But you heard from Dana Vanderford, who runs this program out of Los Angeles County. And she said the biggest challenge they have is not only finding these people who need help, but also convincing them this isn't a scam. You know, someone's not reaching out to scam you and pretend to offer you a few $1,000 in help. This is actual aid, kind of no strings attached. We're looking to help people stabilize, get back on their feet, et cetera. And it's so much better to catch people before they fall into situations like that because, you know, the climb out of homelessness is much more traumatic and more difficult for people to burden.
All right, Kate, thank you very much. Kate Rogers reporting there. Coming up, the consumer not slowing down and spending on travel. It's helped the airlines deliver strong earnings so far, but there is bifurcation happening in that trade. Wall Street's top airline analyst joins us with his top picks from here. We'll be right back. More bifurcation after this. Welcome back to The Exchange, everybody. Airline stocks mixed in today's session, but it has been a strong start to the earnings season for the big names that reported this week.
We had record revenues, and if not for the MAX grounding, we would have been profitable. And so we feel really good about the trends that we're seeing, and we're seeing those trends carry on into the second quarter.
We had a great quarter. The team really delivered a solid set of results. Demand is strong. Set another record.
As we're picking up market share and winning customers, we had strong revenue performance. We had really great domestic performance. We had the best operations that we've had in our history.
Our next guest expects to hear that same sentiment next week when more carriers report. Joining us now is J.P. Morgan's Jamie Baker. He's also in the Institutional Investor Hall of Fame for his coverage of the airline industry. Mr. Baker, welcome. Congratulations on being in the Hall of Fame. Good to see you. So we use the word bifurcation, one of my favorite all-time words in the intro here. There are, I take it, winners in this space like United, Delta, maybe Alaska and others. And then there are some that are not winners. What separates the good from the not so good?
Yeah, you know, I want to choose my words carefully, but I think we can confidently say that COVID turned out to be a structural positive for certain airlines. Right? So COVID obviously wreaked havoc on supply chains. So there are material constraints on the industry's ability to grow. It drove significant wage rate escalation at discount airlines, and they really needed those lower wages to compete. And, you know, I think COVID also, you know, provided a boost for premium demand. And there also seems to be this growing consumer pivot from goods to experiences, particularly international experiences. So you're absolutely right. There has been a bifurcation. It comes down to business models. The airlines that cater, you know, to premium, to international, and have robust frequent flyer programs are the ones that are, you know, really kidnapping, capturing the bulk of industry profitability. Meanwhile, those airlines that only, cater to consumers that care about low ticket prices and don't have loyalty, those airlines are struggling.
You know, I don't mean to make this about me, but it's interesting you mentioned this. I just booked a trip to Europe for the summer, and I went ahead and I splurged for a higher price seat because I want the comfort, I want the experience, and I suspect there are a lot of people who feel that way. So the airlines that, where that is a big part of their core business, they're winning.
Yes, that's correct. And you know, we saw that in the data, you know, this last week. I mean, premium revenue for Delta in the first quarter was up 10%. Meanwhile, mm-hmm. traditional economy was only up 4%. Even American Express today, you know, talked about greater growth in spending on travel and entertainment versus goods and services. So, yes, you are the demographic that the profitable airlines
well, I feel very fortunate.
Are targeting. So thank you on their behalf.
You recently upgraded JetBlue. Why?
Yes. Well, look, JetBlue is in the midst of a turnaround. I do think the prior leadership, under the prior leadership, there was an unacceptably sort of high tolerance for loss production. But the company has a new CEO. They've got a new president. We've seen pretty aggressive cancellations of cities like Baltimore or Kansas City, you know, which were large money losers. You know, at the same time, you have an activist shareholder, Carl Icahn, who's involved. You know, very negative sentiment on the name. I would say that the upgrade wasn't driven so much by valuation as it was the potential for sentiment to begin shifting in JetBlue's favor. And that, of course, could help the stock.
Demand seems, according to the CEOs there, demand seems to be very strong. Is there any sign of any slowing in demand that you can detect?
Quite honestly, no. You know, I've taken the question as to whether, you know, some of the safety, you know, headlines mm-hmm. Might impact demand at a high level. It doesn't seem to be changing consumer behavior. I obviously, you know, I see the occasional social media posts, you know, oh, planes are falling apart. I'm going to drive to Orlando instead, which is just ridiculous. I mean, that's like buying cancer. I mean, no offense, but who thinks that way? So we're really not seeing any slowdown in unrelentingly strong demand. But again, it skews towards premium, and it's also very robust in longer haul international markets.
Let's talk a little bit about the safety issues that have bedeviled Boeing and then as a knock-on effect, some of the airlines. Do you expect that the worst of that may be behind us as an industry, and how material have those disruptions been for some of the carriers?
Well, look, from where I sit, and I'm not an engineer, I'm not a mechanic, I'm not a pilot, you know, there really has not been an appreciable increase in maintenance events, but there has been an increase in media scrutiny. You know, obviously the Alaska door issue was one of a kind, highly unusual.
Right.
But things like the occasional compressor stall, wheel issues, the occasional plane that vacates the runway. You know, I don't want to spook anybody, but on a global basis, just given the sheer number of flights every day, these aren't all that unusual. I think here in the U.S., it's a little like the summer of the shark, if you remember that one.
We got to leave it there, Jamie. Thanks very much. Have a great weekend, my friend.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. And that does it for The Exchange. Power Lunch is up after this quick break. See you there.
You've been listening to The Exchange. Make sure you're subscribed to get each episode every day, same time, same place.